You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Following the provincial budget in March, the BC Liberals announced they were cutting dental support and medical diagnostic equipment for the disabled and those on welfare. A $75 a month shelter allowance for people who don't pay rent will also be eliminated at the beginning of June, and dental care rules for people on low income will also change. These cuts and a handful of others directly affect the day-to-day lives of people already facing hardship, and it will deepen their poverty. I'm joined this morning by Martha Roberts, who's a registered midwife and an organizer with the Alliance for People's Health. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning. Nice to be here today.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. Now, let's start with the comfort allowance, which was taken away from people who don't have a home to stay in. What did people use that $75 for in their day-to-day lives?
Well, if you imagine that you were, if you didn't have a permanent resident, what kind of costs would you incur that you wouldn't incur if you had, say, laundry machines where you could do your laundry, or a washroom where you had 24/7 access? I mean, really, the comfort allowance was there to supplement the expenses that people who are living on the street incur by, in fact, not having a permanent residence. So if you imagine you're downtown and you need to use the washroom, where do you go? You often need to go into a business, you need to purchase a coffee or something to use the washroom, or you want to go into a community center, you want to take a shower. I mean, these kinds of expenses are incurred by people who live on the street. It's really meant to supplement their income and also provide them a measure of human dignity. I live in a co-op in the downtown east side, and our parking garage is a place that's used as a toilet for people who live in the downtown east side, and it really exposes the necessity of both the income for people who don't have a residence, as well as things like toilets.
I think for those of us who do have a home, if we think about, you know, where $75 might go in a month, you know, just in terms of, you know, everything from toilet paper to, you know, all the little things that we just completely take for granted, it's really kind of remarkable that the government would cut something just so basic.
I mean, really, if you look at the situation now for people who are low income overall, as well as people who are extremely marginalized, and that would be the homeless population, what we need to do is increase social spending and increase the transfer of wealth from those who have to those who have not. Not actually, what we're doing is seeing the reverse.
Now, the government called that allowance an outdated policy. What do you make of that?
Well, I can't really get where they're coming from with that. Honestly, it doesn't seem to make sense to me. The way that text reads, and this is coming from the provincial government, it reads like people should just get a house. Like it really exposes the lack at the provincial level of any kind of strategy to deal with the fact that we have homelessness in our society, and we also have a whole other subset of people who are just on the verge of homelessness. I mean, even if we look at the way we define homelessness, it doesn't cut the mustard, really. I mean, people who share houses or 15 people in one house, I mean, are those people really not homeless? How do we define homes? So I can't really answer about why they call it an outdated policy, because that seems to me to be a way of them saying, we've addressed the problem and this is no longer a problem for our government. Homelessness isn't an issue.
Now, some basic health supports for people living with a life-threatening disease are being reduced or cut. What were those benefits and how are they being affected?
Well, if you imagine you're a low-income person who's living with a chronic disease, you're living with cancer, you're living with chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, you're living with diabetes, you've got emphysema. If you imagine what are the expenses that you might incur that aren't covered by your MSP premiums. So you're looking at things like glucometers to test your blood sugar, you're looking at test strips, you're looking at some of the things that they're continuing to fund. They say they're still continuing to fund airway pressure machines. So if you have emphysema, you can still have your air pressure, but you no longer are eligible for optical exams or for dental care. I mean, these kinds of things aren't considered to be under the umbrella of the life-threatening disease. So if you've got diabetes, you're no longer getting your eye exams. So maybe it's true that you can still live without your eyes, But let's talk about quality of life and how these people are going to survive.
And I mean, I guess the other thing is the kind of effect of stress when you're already facing a life-threatening illness, and then to have on top of that the stress of not having some of these other medical areas covered.
One of the things that they're actually cutting with the life-threatening health need is access to physiotherapy services. And just my limited experience, I mean, I'm a registered midwife, so I deliver babies. I don't look after people with lung disorders. But I see the children in the hospital who do have lung disorders and the importance of physiotherapy to their treatment overall. And if you're a senior who has a lung disorder, physiotherapy is a major component of your treatment. So I'm not really sure how they justify this cut. And the amount of money they're saving, they say $2 million in 2 years. I mean, this is a drop in the bucket in the provincial government. We look at how much money they spent on the Olympics. Are they really saying that a party is more important than care for people who have life-threatening illness?
Now, dental benefits for low-income people are also changing. What's happening there?
Well, the dental services is a little bit of a mixed bag. So what they're doing is that they're taking the Healthy Kids program, which was or is a program that covers dental care for low-income families. So you don't need to be a welfare recipient. You just need to be under the income cutoff, which I think is about $30,000 a year. And at that, they'll do a graduated top-up. So low-income families will be eligible. It used to be $700 a year for their kids. So each kid would get $700 towards dental care. What they've done, they've extended that period to 2 years and capped it at $1,400. So it's not actually a cut. It's a shift in the policy. And they say that this increases flexibility for their clients. And it does in some ways. Like if a child has a bike accident and needs a tooth replaced or a cap, that you can now as a parent afford that all in one go and not have to pay out of pocket. But then what happens in the second year when you've maxed your payments? So what this means in many cases is that parents will spend the money up front and then they won't have the money in the consecutive year to cover it. They've reduced a number of cleanings and fluoride treatments that kids are eligible for to once a year from twice a year. Mm. And same with x-rays from once a year to once every 2 years. So now we're looking at kids who often will have dental caries that will be identified only with x-ray because of the spacing of their teeth, will not be able to visualize those cavities. So by the time they're treated, they're actually more expensive and more difficult to treat than they would have been if they'd been detected earlier. So it allows more flexibility, but that term, I think, is a way of cushioning what they're actually doing, which is reducing the cost that they're spending that has the potential impact, probable impact, I would say, of increasing the amount of treatment that kids will need.
Mm. Now, there's also changes, legislation to deny welfare and disability to people who have warrants for indictable offenses. Now, for some people, it can be easy to have, like, no sympathy for the people affected by that. How do you see the effect of that law?
Well, what I see, just kind of a broad analytical approach, is that they're taking the onus of supporting people who are low income off of the Ministry of Housing and Social Development and shifting it over to be a justice issue. So we say these people are lawbreakers, they're not deserving of social support. Even though if you look at the definition of what's included under the lawbreaking, first of all, these are warrants, so they're not proven offenses. This is a suspicion that someone has committed a crime. So until you've proven that you didn't commit that crime that you're suspected of committing, you're not eligible for support. So it really shifts it from being, you have a need, we're going to try to fill your financial need. And I mean, what does it take for someone to go to welfare? I mean, there's this idea out there that people just walk into welfare and get money. It doesn't really work that way. It's a very difficult, humiliating process. So now someone has to sign a waiver saying that they're not a lawbreaker, or that the state has the right to investigate whether or not they've been accused of committing a crime. And, you know, I was speaking with Ayana Sorman, who's an organizer with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and what he sees daily is that people who are from small communities will be targeted by the police and accused of committing crimes that they didn't necessarily commit. If you come from a one-horse town and you're not liked by that police officer, then it goes without saying that it's likely that you're going to have a warrant out in your name for something that you may or may not have committed. And it may be something as small as eating in a restaurant and you didn't have the money and you left without paying.
Hmm. Now, these cuts appeared, as you mentioned, very shortly after a very extravagant weeks-long party for the Winter Olympics. What does this say about our priorities for spending public dollars?
Well, really, when you look at the cuts overall, I think that one of the key themes that comes out of that for me as a community health organizer, as a midwife, as well as someone who, you know, believes that wealth should be redistributed from those who have to those who have not, it really smacks of the fact that we have a provincial government whose priority is in building profit for the corporate businesses who bolster their political campaigns, and not actually for the commitment of, you know, why do we pay taxes? Because we want social programs that support those who are the most in need. It's one of the supposed values of Canadian society. So I really think that that exposes their commitment that they're going to support business over the people.
Overall, what are your kind of criticisms of the, we've talked about these pieces in general, but what is this kind of lack of support for people who are the poorest in our society? What do you see as the kind of long-term and structural effects of that as a health, as a person who's involved in the health world?
Well, what I know about British Columbia is that we have in Canada the greatest inequality gap between the poorest and the richest, and Vancouver is one of the most expensive cities to live in the world. So we're already in a situation where there's a great health gap. This is what we call it at the Alliance for People's Health. It's a health gap. And what we know from research by leading public health theoreticians is that the greater the health gap in your society, the worse health for everybody who lives in that society. So you could be a middle income earner, but your health is actually going to be impacted by the fact that we have inequality in our society. We see higher stress levels, we see lower satisfaction levels, we see people who are more prone to developing chronic disease, diabetes, heart disease. I mean, we see that all of these things are impacted by inequality in our society. And of course, those who pay the most are those at the bottom of the rung. We live in a society that really punishes the poor and gives kudos to the rich, and I think it should be switched around. What we really see at the Alliance for People's Health is that what we need to do is use health and use health services as a way to increase not only health services for the poor, but also participation and community control. So we see a totally different way of conceiving the way health needs could be organized that would decrease that inequality gap as opposed to increasing it.
Now, you've got Alliance for People's Health is sponsoring a People's Health series. Tell us about what you're planning there.
So we have a series that's running on Sundays starting at the end of May, and it's 8 sessions. 5 of them are more of a classroom type session where we do some popular education on community health issues, and 3 of them are more participatory action sessions. But the overall theme of the People's Health series is how can we use health services and health prevention. We have a real focus on prevention as opposed to the biomedical disease framework, to actually organize in our communities to build political power and address what we call the structural determinants of health, which are community participation and community control. And what we know is that when you look at social movements historically, people who participate in social movements actually have improved health outcomes. And it's not so much the gains of the social movement itself. Like if you look at the civil rights movement, there's a lot of research that said that African American communities that were active in the civil rights movement had improved health outcomes. It's not so much the gains per se, but actually the involvement in the struggle that increased people's health, because they're taking action to actually reduce that gap instead of relying on charity.
Mm. So how would people find out about the events that are coming up in the health series?
I think the best thing, the best way to get information about the Alliance for People's Health, People's Health series, is to go to our website, okay, which is aphvan, so aphvan.wordpress.com. And if you take a look at our website, all of the information on the People's Health series is there. We are asking people to register for all 8 sessions because there's a flow to the series that kind of trains you to be a community organizer.
Fantastic. Now, you've brought in a fantastic poster for March that's going to be happening.
Yes.
Right after the long weekend.
Well, in talking about the improvement of health outcomes for participating in struggle, We're actually the Organizing Center for Economic and or Social and Economic Justice, which is the parent organization of the APH, is participating in a rally that's organized by VANDU and by CCAP out of the Carnegie Center and the Raise the Rates Coalition. So it'll be on Tuesday, May 25th at 2 p.m. at Main and Hastings, and it's a rally to stop the welfare cuts.
Excellent. So we'll repeat that information for people. It's Tuesday, May 25th at 2 p.m. You gather at Main and Hastings. Martha, thank you very much for coming
in. You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Martha Roberts. She's a registered midwife and an organizer with the Alliance for People's Health.